Conrad.
Good morning. It's time to read the Mason City Globe Gazette for Sunday, January 19. My name's Mike Dam, and my partner at the microphone for the next hour is Susan Wiley. We're pleased to be with you. This broadcast is made possible through a partnership between Iowa Radio Reading Information Service and 97.9 FM KCMI Radio. Here are today's headlines on the front page of the Globe Gazette. Council considers latest improvements program. Abortion battle looming at Iowa Capitol. And there's a picture of a man with a peregrine falcon. And it says, North Iowan trains state's first wild peregrine falcon. Weather today, mostly sunny but frigid today. Limit time outdoors if possible. Expect 48 hours of sunshine with average relative humidity of 85% and poor drying conditions. Frigid tonight, dangerously cold. Limit time outdoors, average relative humidity 85%. Sunshine tomorrow, limit outdoor activity recommended. So for the next few days, it's going to be extremely cold. Today, high of 1. Tonight, the low 11 below. Monday, 3 above and 9 below. And then Tuesday, it starts to warm up 10 below, 13 for a high, 10 below for a low. Then Wednesday, we get back up to 36. 29 for a low, and 35 on Thursday, 29 for a low. We are extremely cold, but sunny through Tuesday. Wednesday, showers of rain or snow, depending upon the temperature. And Thursday is cloudy with a bit of snow. So with our first story, here's Susan Wiley.
Thank you, Mike. Good morning. Okay, so Jared McNett writes that the council considers latest improvements program. While the Mason City Council's work session on Thursday night was singular in focus, it was more expansive in what was covered. Officials met at the City Hall and reviewed the newest capital improvement budget, which serves both forecast and guide for what Mason City hopes to get done. From 2020 to 2024, city officials estimate that there will be all listed projects to go through on or around budget that would spend nearly $119 million on various department programs. A chunk of what that money could come from specific utility renewals, such as water and sewer, but there would also be money coming in from grants and the city's reserve of general obligation bonds. We try to be conservative as possible while still managing to take care of projects that are needed in the community, City Administrator Aaron Burnett, near the beginning of the meeting. So that would mean for a fiscal year of 2021, there would be about $24.5 million in need of expenditures. One forecasted driver of that estimated work on a taxiway at the Mason City Airport that's listed at $4.5 million. At least part of that would be offset by about $3 million in federal funding that the airport received in November through the Airport Improvement Program. Coming in at about $1.75 million is a projected cost of paving on Monroe Avenue that will be funded through road use tax funds, grants, sewer, water revenues, according to City Finance Director Kevin Jacobson. Most projects using some amount of road use tax funds are annual ones that are done to maintain streets in those areas of the city. Those have significant funding from grants and federal dollars. Other public works in the realm include street lighting on South Federal for about $750,000 to $450,000 for cross repairs and $125,000 for traffic signal updates. Sewer work coming forth. Work on Mason City's sewer systems totaled about $1.8 million in project expenditures, with about $1 million accounted for by fund revenues alone, a necessary nutrient reduction program for runoff ate up about $500,000 of a $1.8 million, and while would be mostly improve replacing equipment at treatment plant that has outlived its effectiveness. The average sewer bill in Mason City runs about 17.17 A month through there would be a projected 2.83 increase to continue the revenue generation for such work. Burnett said that the sewer system is one particular area where spending, if possible, could be perpetual. You can spend as much money as you can raise. The infrastructure, the exits in most cities is aged and frankly inadequate for the amount of rainfalls we get in this age. So there's a strong competition between the rate that the projects need to be completed and the amount that needs to be raised, to which Jacobson later added, "We know the rate increase and don't want to increase that burden to the citizens." When discussing the expenditures needed for ongoing updating work for Mason City City Parks rec program, Jacobson was quick to point out that at least $400,000 of the arena project debt would be carried over from the year prior. The biggest ticket item still is awaiting completion, and that's $200,000 for a high line train, or $200 million probably. Part of the overall work on the new path was particularly bonded, but in July, it was announced that additional private funding would be required to finish the work. Throughout the presentation, it was repeatedly emphasized that Burnett and Jacobson, that there was forecasting is conservative for a reason. It's important that we continue to put the city in the best position as far as revenues that we can count on. For this part, Jacobson was briefer still. This is a fluid process. There are estimates. Reach reporter Jared McNett at 641-421-0527. Mike?
Thank you, Susan.
You're welcome. Thank you.
North Iowan trains state's first wild peregrine falcon. If Jack Vogie had lost one more drop of blood, I should have called for a medevac. I was springing a leak or two myself, but my injuries were nothing compared to the sight of Jack's hands and wrist. The meat grinder was the term that came to mind. It was early October in northern Minnesota, and we were engaged in a painful process of removing an entangled peregrine falcon from the webbing of our mist net. Utilizing its hooked beak with machine gun rapidity, the enraged female was snipping away chunks of human hide with all the efficiency of a woodpecker tearing at a rotten log. Ben Olander was our party's third member, a world authority on northern goshawks. The Denmark native has trapped hundreds of migrant hawks and put our situation into perspective. Ben noted he had never seen a hawk as wild as this one, nor had he ever witnessed a bird that bit so frequently or with such devastating effect. Don't get me wrong. No one was complaining. Netting a wild peregrine is always a stellar accomplishment, but for me, the event had an even greater significance. The captured falcon represented the big-time payoff of an intense 2-year quest aimed at obtaining a wild peregrine to be used in falconry, the ancient art of hunting wild game with a trained raptor. Critically endangered during the 70s, peregrine populations have recovered to the extent that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has currently sanctioned a limited take of the young of the year birds for falconry. In Iowa and Minnesota are each granted 5 permits annually, and trapping dates are timed to intercept Arctic nesting, tundras it's called, falcons en route to South America wintering grounds. In early training is the header. Once the falcon was safely removed from the net, we quickly fitted the bird with a hood, jesses, swivel, and leash. Following the application of a few bandages, we celebrated our good fortune. Although ecstatic over the prospect of training the freshly trapped falcon, I was also somewhat apprehensive. As Olander noted, none of us had ever seen a hawk more vicious in temperament. But first impressions can be deceiving, and I remained optimistic. Driving state back home in northern Iowa, I immediately began training. The initial process of getting a falcon adjusted to being near humans is called manning, and the way to a raptor's heart is through its stomach. Sitting in a dimly lit room, I offered the falcons tidbits of meat, which she, of course, refused. On the second day, she decided to tentatively accept my offerings. By weekend, she was enthusiastically feeding in full light. During our second week, I began hopping the falcon from her perch to my fist. On week three, I introduced her to a lure, a leather disc garnished with meat, then swung on a line, and the lure is used to recover a falcon during free flights. For the time being, however, the hawk would remain clipped to a 40-yard-long leash while being called to the lure once each day. During our week-long session, she never once flew over the lure or attempted to escape, but most amazingly was the change in the falcon's demeanor. By the end of our second week, her personality had transitioned from fearsome dragon lady to the sweetest, calmest, gentlest bird I've handled. By the end of the week, third week, she was ready for fly free. But although the falcon may have been ready for free flight, I was not. I have literally been dreaming of flying a wild peregrine since I was 10 years old. And although I've flown a total of 14 captive reared peregrines over the years, this bird was more precious. This would be the first wild hatched peregrine to ever be flown in Iowa. And the last thing I intended to do was lose her because of inadequate training. But following a few more sessions with the lure, I realized it was past time to bite the bullet and turn her loose. For the falconer, a new hawk's first flight is a harrowing experience. At this stage of the game, the bond between wild bird and human handler is fragile at best. Once it leaves the glove, the falcon can say adios whenever it likes. This is especially true with highly migratory Arctic birds. Upon leaving their summer nesting cliffs in Northern California and the coastal Greenland, the falcons marked with satellite transmitters have reached wintering grounds in Chile and southern Brazil in as little as 10 days. The peregrine I was about to liberate has been doing just fine before we met, and she certainly didn't need me now. If she chose, she could easily continue her journey and be chasing shorebirds in the sunny South America by sometime next week. Up, up, and away is the subheading. Traveling to an open hilltop, I set the falcon on a perch, removed her hood and leash, turning my back, and walked away. After moving a distance upwind, I turned and produced the lure. The peregrine immediately took wing, came directly to the garnished offering as if we'd been doing this for years. Falcons are not pets, and I usually don't name my birds. In this case, I made an exception and I decided to call the hawk Aurora, a symbolic reference to the remote, unknown regions of whence she came. I soon began launching Aurora directly from the glove, letting her wander the sky a bit longer with each session. On a crisp afternoon in early December, the falcon climbed into the wind and kept going until she was lost to view. Although I could no longer see her, I had equipped the bird with a tail-mounted telemetry transmitter and was able to track her general whereabouts with a radio receiver. Although the transmitter signal varied at times, it eventually grew strong enough until I spotted the bird returning to my position. I was never happier to see a hawk descend to the lure. For me, the event was both scary and exciting, a stark reminder of how easily the bird could resume her life in the wild. Since that December afternoon, it has not been uncommon for Aurora to range beyond my vision, but she has always returned. Her loyalty is amazing. She's the only falcon that I haven't had to beep down with telemetry on at least a few occasions. Susan?
That was a nice story, Mike. Thank you. Okay, so Sierra Gorda County Supervisor Chris Watts announces re-election bid. And so announced this week he'd be seeking re-election for the seat that he's held since 2016. Press release Watts was who oversees the county's Eastern District 3 pointed to steps that he and his fellow supervisors had taken over the past several weeks to improve the county while also saving money where possible. One particular point of pride was the board's history in this time, in his time there, of refusing to pay raises each and every they I don't understand that. Were recommended by the county's compensation board, even while salaries for elected county officials went up. Oh, never been done before, Watts said. He also pointed out that the county social services tax levy, as well as the border tax levy, had fallen for three straight years. Although more than a few residents in Cerro Gordo County have complained about increases in their personal property tax over the past year. Another cost-saving measure that Watts drew attention to was a decision in July 2019 to sunset benefits for county employees who are at least 58 and worked at least 30 years, who are 60 and worked for 20 years, and elected officials who serve at least two terms until they qualify for Medicare. Those who are already retired and benefiting from the program, which was enacted more than a decade ago, were grandfathered in while anyone hired after 2010 wasn't eligible. The savings estimated provided by the county totaled about $4.4 million, and Tom Meyer, the county's director of administrative services, said that the number would have continued to increase if the county didn't take steps to curb it. At the time, all three supervisors noted that the decision to end the program was not one they took lightly, and Supervisor Tim Lathan ultimately decided to vote against the measure, while Watts and Supervisor Casey Cullinan voted for it. In making his decision, Cullinan said that it would only be possible for the counties to sustain the program if it raised taxes or fees, put an increased insurance cost onto the employees. Watson, his release, said an estimate provided by the county's budget director, Heather Marthrith, showed that this plan has cost taxpayers about $881,504 in health insurance premiums since it went into effect back in 1998. It's in terms of infrastructure, Watts recalled the county's recent decision to move forward on the new building for the engineering department that would consolidate multiple county facilities to save money and get with the times. By fall of 2020, the department, which oversees more than 267 miles per paved road, 700 miles of gravel road, and 156 bridges, plans to open an administrative building just west of the county's law enforcement center on Lark Avenue. According to Watts, money the county would generate from the sale of the old engineering properties will fund new facilities. Watts also made sure to trumpet increased county transparency over the past 4 years, particularly in terms of applications for volunteer board vacancies. He said that in the past, the process was more opaque and often based on who knows who, whereas it is now more formal public application process. I'm excited about and looking forward to the next 4 years in the courthouse and what this board can accomplish together with our citizens and county employees. Watts reaffirmed in his release, consolidation and streamlining county operations and services while still serving citizens and saving them money is top priority for me. As of now, Watts is running unopposed for his seat. Mike?
Okay. We've got some pictures here of some motorcycles and go-karts. A day of thunder races heat up winter-weary North Iowans. And one of the pictures, a racer competes Saturday in a go-kart during a 2020 Day of Thunder on Syrup races at the North Iowa Event Center in Mason City. There's another one, a guy on a motorcycle competing, and then one with a motorcycle racer skidding across the track going down, and then remote-control drivers are also featured as they drive their cars around the track between races Saturday during the 2020 Day of Thunder on Syrup races at the North Iowa Event Center. As the frigid winds raged outside, the racing action was heating up inside the All Seasons building at North Iowa Event Center. The annual A Day of Thunder on Syrup kart races were held Saturday, where heat after heat of carts, bikes, and quads raced around the cement track coated in a slick syrup, giving extra traction for racers on the tiny indoor course. While the weather caused some logistical problems, the show had to go on, as there were no available postponement dates for the venue. Competitor pits were all moved inside the main venue, and some classes were combined to ensure everyone had a chance to compete. Spectators watched as kids and adults competed for trophies in various classes throughout the day. Between the racing action, people brought their remote control racing cars onto the track to race each other. The races were sponsored by the North Iowa Fair Association and Monster Energy Drink.
Thank you, Mike. LaJames grand opening a new boutique in Lake Mills. And Sarah Schultz writes of Albert Lee Tribune, a Lake Mills woman has started a new business focused on helping people feel beautiful. K&P Aesthetics opened December 3rd in the back of 103 North Mill Street in Lake Mills. Owner Kylie Wilkerson said she offers facials, back facials, chemical peels, body waxing, facial waxing, eyelash tints, and hopes to get certified in lash extensions and offer services in the future. I love the aspect of making people feel good about themselves, helping seeing results, knowing that the importance of skincare and taking care of your body and trying to stop the aging process. So far, the business has been going well, and there have been many people, local residents from around the area who have been coming in. She works by appointment in the late afternoon and evening and weekday and some Saturdays. Wilkerson said she began researching aesthetics about a year ago and completed a 600-hour skincare aesthetics program at LaJames College in Mason City. She said she's a single mother and she didn't finish college her first time around and has been waitressing for 11 years. I've tried different careers here and there. I just never loved them. I always fell back on waitressing. I love it so much, but I knew I needed to find a career that was going to be a forever thing. She was initially terrified to go back to school at age 29 when she had a daughter in school, but then one day she said her mindset shifted. I'm going back to school and I'm trying to show my daughter what it takes to work hard looks like. So I did it and my mindset has changed so much. Through the last year has been difficult working a full-time job at the other place in Clear Lake when she waitresses and even coordination going to school 5 to 6 days a week. She's proud to have completed this anesthetic program and now own her own business. The business K&P Aesthetics includes initials for both her name and her daughter, Paisley, first name. She and her daughter is seven, said her daughter is seven and loves coming to work with her. Wilkerson said she comes from an entrepreneurial background. Her parents own Wilkerson's Tool and Die and Midwest Metal Stamping in Lake Mills and has learned the value of hard work. I've had a job since I was 14. That's one of the things that I hold near and dear to me. One of my friends owns Quinn and Company in downtown Lake Mills and allowed her to rent the back part of the building for her spa business. It's been amazing, Wilkerson said. I could not ask for anything better. Mike?
Okay, we're about a minute two, so I'm going to start remembrances, I guess. We'll read the names, and by then it'll be 8:30 when we start reading. Ardeen G. Rasmussen of Garner, Norma Jean Billieu of Forest City, Lena DeMarco, of Mason City, Harold Bud Helm Jr., Mason City, Marjorie F. Marge Booth of Ventura, Shirley Ann Van Slyke. It doesn't give a city. Lorraine M. Marker of Manly. And three funeral notices. Geraldine Clunder, Mason City. Kim Martin, Mason City. And Dixie Benkin of Clarion. Ardeen G. Rasmussen, 93 Garner, passed away Wednesday, January 15, at Concord Care Center in Garner. Funeral services will be held 10:30 a.m. Monday, January 20, at United Presbyterian Church in Garner with Reverend Justin Ashy officiating. Burial will be at the Concord Township Cemetery. Visitation will be held from 4 to 6 p.m. Sunday at Cataldo Funeral Chapel in Garner and will resume 1 hour prior to services at the church. Memorials may be directed to United Presbyterian Church or the Garner Volunteer Ambulance Service. Our Dean Gustava Rasmussen, the daughter of Oscar and Jelena Hunt Munson, was born July 4th, 1926, in Marshalltown. At an early age, she moved with her family to Wesley, where she graduated from high school in 1945. For a short time, she was a receptionist at Park Inn Hotel in Mason City. She met Curtis Rasmussen at the Surf Ballroom in Clear Lake. They later married in August 31, 1947, at the Little Brown Church in Nashua. They lived and farmed on the Rasmussen Farm north of Garner and raised their family. In 1977, they moved into Garner. Our Dean and Curtis enjoyed golfing, traveling in their motorhome throughout the United States, including Alaska, and wintering in California. Our Dean enjoyed her family, playing cards, and going to workshop at the church. She was a member of the United Presbyterian Church, where she taught Sunday school, UPW, Homemakers Club, and North Garner Community Club. In her younger years, she was a 4-H leader and home economics judge at the Hancock County Fair. Cataldo Funeral Home is helping with arrangements. Norma Jean Hillsland Bilyeu, 90, passed away on Thursday, January 16, at Westview Care Center in Britt. Memorial service will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Friday, May 1, at Forest City United Methodist Church. And May 1 is correct from what it says here, with Pastor Les Green officiating. Visitation will be from 4 to 6, Thursday, April 30, at Ward Vance Lake Colonial Chapel in Clear Lake. Norma Jean was born February 27, 1929, the daughter of Edward and Joy Olson Hillsland of Forest City. She grew up in Forest City and graduated from Garner High School. Norma attended Kendall College in Evanston, Illinois, as well as Waldorf College in Forest City. Norma married Roy Bilyeu on February 4, 1950, and lived on the family farm near Woden, Iowa. To this union, 4 children were born, 2 sons and 2 daughters. In later years, they moved to Mason City, where she helped Roy with his business and was very active in her children's lives. Norma was a Cub Scout den mother, a member of Lincoln Elementary PTA, and a Sunday school at First United Methodist Church. Norma was always active in her local churches. She taught her children to pray, read scriptures, and value family. Norma enjoyed drop-in guests at her kitchen table, serving coffee and treats almost every day. Ward Vance Lake Colonial Chapel and Clear Lake is helping with arrangements.
Okay. Shirley Ann Vance Lake. Shirley was born August 14, 1926 in Mitchell, South Dakota, to Ella M. and Charles Ward Reynolds. Shirley's family moved to Covina, California, where Shirley attended school and graduated from Covina Union High School in 1943. Shirley then attended UCLA. In 1945, Shirley married First Lieutenant Richard Lyle Vance Lake. The couple moved to Clear Lake, Iowa in 1947, where Dick was the funeral director, and Shirley enjoyed raising her family, playing bridge and her friends, golfing, and being part of the Beta Sigma Phi. In Shirley's later years, she enjoyed spending with her companion, Joe Egli. Shirley and Joe were active and enjoyed spending time with their children and grandchildren. And that's all it says about that. Lorraine M. Marker, 91, Manly, passed away Tuesday, January 14th, 2020, at the Waterford assisted living in Ames, surrounded by her family. Funeral services will be held at 1:30 p.m. Saturday, January 25th, 2020, at the Bethel United Methodist Church in Manly. But with the Reverend Corey Allard officiating, and burial will be in the Plymouth Cemetery beside her husband, John. Visitation will be held from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. Friday, January 24th, at the Bride Colonial Chapel in Manly, and visitation will continue 1 hour prior to the service at the church. Lorraine Marie Marker was born October 24th, 1928, at the Manly, Iowa, George Dietrich Markin and Mathilda School, and graduated from Manly High School in 46. She worked at the Bell Telephone Company for 2 years. On May 11th, 47, she married John George Marker in Bethel Evangelical Church in Manly. After her marriage, she lived on the family farm until April of 83, when they moved to Manly. Lorraine was a lifetime member of Bethel United Methodist Church, where she was baptized and confirmed. Her church was very special and important to her. She served as a junior YF leader, Bible school superintendent, church secretary. She was one of the original members of the Christian Home Builders and UMW member. Willing Workers Circle member, attending adult Sunday school classes, discipline groups, and Beth Bible study groups. She was also a member of the Manly Legion Auxiliary, RSVP, the Manly Camera Club. Lorraine was proud of her family and greatly enjoyed time spent with them. She also enjoyed traveling and the opportunity to see beauty of God's world. And Bride Colonial Chapel is in charge of arrangements in Manly. Mike?
Harold Bud Helm, Jr., 89, of Mason City, died on Monday, January 13, at Heritage Care and Rehabilitation Center. The funeral service will be held on Monday, January 20, at 10:30 a.m. at St. James Lutheran Church in Mason City. Interment will be in Memorial Park Cemetery. Visitation will be held 1 hour prior to the service time on Monday. The family would like to thank the staff of Heritage Care and Rehabilitation Center for their love and care of Harold over the past 5 years. To honor his memory, memorials may be made to the family for purchases to enhance Heritage residents' lives and support Heritage staff in caring for residents. Memorials may also be made to the Alzheimer's Association in Waterloo, Iowa. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.majorericksonfuneralhome.com. Harold was born March 4, 1930, the first son of Harold Harry and Alice Preby Helm. Harold attended school at Mason City, graduating from Mason City High School in the class in 1948. Following graduation, he worked for Decker's Packing Plant and joined the Army that summer. He served in the Korean War as an infantryman and was part of the 1st Battalion, 8th Calgary Regiment. He was honorably discharged from the Army in December 1951. He returned to work as a livestock buyer in New Hampton, Charles City, Mason City, Clear Lake, and Worthington, Minnesota, for a total of 42 years of service. While in New Hampton, Harold met Sarah Rath Peru, and they married December 9, 1961. Harold became stepfather to Sarah's three children, Dawn, Monty, and Randy. Harold and Sarah had three daughters together. The Helm family moved from Charles City to Mason City in 1965. Harold and Sarah enjoyed 39 years of marriage until her death in 2000. Harold was an avid racing fan, a hobby he enjoyed from his teen years until his early 80s. He was an accomplished bowler, winning city tournaments in both Charles City and Mason City. Most of all, Harold loved spending time with his family and friends. He was a friend to young and old alike. Arrangements are with Major Erickson Funeral Home and Crematory in Mason City. Marjorie F. Marge Booth, 84, of Manly and formerly of Ventura, died Wednesday, January 15, at Manly Care Center in Manly. The funeral service will be held at 2:30 p.m. on Monday, January 20, at Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel in Mason City. Burial will follow in Memorial Park Cemetery in Mason City. Visitation with public viewing will be held Sunday afternoon, January 19, from 1 to 3 at Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel, and resume 1 hour prior to Marge's service at the funeral home. Should friends desire, memorials may be left in Marge's name in care of her family. The daughter of Wesley and Amanda Bean Wilkerson, Marjorie was born on April 15, 1935, in Austin, Minnesota. She attended Mason City High School. She was united in marriage to Samuel Booth at Little Brown Church in Nashua. Together, they were blessed with 4 children. For many years, the family resided on an acreage near Mason City, where Marge tended the home and raised their children. Friends and family alike loved visiting Uncle Sam and Aunt Marge's, where countless hours were spent fishing along the Winnebago River. In 1985, the family moved to Ventura and began renovations on their dream home. Marge and Sam loved decorating for Christmas in Ventura, and in the winter months could oftentimes be found working on jigsaw puzzles together. Marge loved cooking and hosting the family for Sunday afternoon dinners. In her free time, she enjoyed tending to her flowers and vegetable gardens, as well as sewing and embroidering. Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel is helping with arrangements.
Okay, thank you, Mike. Lena Marie DeMarco, 102, passed away Friday, January 17th at Mercy One North Iowa Hospice. A massive Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Friday, January 24th at Epiphany Parish Holy Family Catholic Church, and Reverend Neil Matternach will officiate, and burial will be at the Elmwood St. Joseph Cemetery in Mason City. Visitation will be from 4 to 6 p.m. on Thursday, January 23rd at the Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel. A vigil with a rosary service to follow will start at 6 p.m. Lena was born July 21st, 1917, the daughter of Catherine Clement and Maria DeFranco Vita of Hurley, Wisconsin. And Lena graduated from J.P. Murphy High School, Hurley, Wisconsin, with a class of 35. She continued her education at the College of St. Socialista in Duluth, Minnesota, graduating in 1939 with a Bachelor of Science degree in Medical Records Library Science. Lena started working at the St. Joseph Mercy Hospital and Medical Records Librarian. Lena married Levino DeMarco on October 16, 41, in Hurley, Wisconsin, at St. Mary's Catholic Church. From this union, 6 children were born. Lena was active in Epiphany Parish and was a member of the Parish Guild, Catholic Daughters of America, various other social groups. Lena was devoted to her family. She was proud to be Italian and of her heritage, and shared many Italian meals with her family and friends. Hogan Bremer Moore Chapel is in charge of arrangements.
We've got 3 funeral notices, obituaries. Geraldine A. Clunder, 83, of Mason City, passed away Tuesday, January 14, at Oakwood Care Center in Clear Lake. A graveside will take place at a later date. Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel is helping with arrangements. Kim Martin, 59, passed away at his home on Monday, January 13, in Mason City. Kim's family will greet relatives and friends from 5 p.m. until 7 on Thursday, January 23, at Plymouth Bible Baptist Church in Plymouth. Burial will take place in the spring. Dixie Binken, 75, Clarion, died January 15. At Iowa Specialty Hospital in Clarion. Funeral services 11 a.m. Tuesday at Clarion United Methodist Church. Burial in the Evergreen Cemetery in Clarion. Visitation will be from 10 a.m. until the time of funeral services at the church Tuesday. Andrew's Funeral Home in Belmont, Iowa is helping with arrangements.
Okay, be ready for the Iowa caucuses. John Skipper writes, there's going to be a surprise in the upcoming Iowa caucuses. There's almost always is, and a surprise can have impact. As far as back as 76, Jimmy Carter, a little-known peanut farmer from Georgia, who later became state's governor, came to Iowa early in the, and often knocking on doors, speaking to service clubs, and engaging in the old-fashioned retail politics. On caucus night, Carter finished higher than any other Democrat candidate. The next day, he was a guest on the morning television show programs. The next week, he was on the cover of the Time magazine. The next week, he was a president of the United States. It all started in Iowa. In 1980, Ronald Reagan was presumed Republican candidate would run against Carter. His campaign took the Iowa caucuses for granted, and whoops, George Bush, who at the time was a loyal Republican stalwart, defeated Reagan in Iowa. Reagan lost several and served as a wake-up call for his campaign and went to the win. The nomination for the presidency, it all started with his loss of Iowa. Then he picked the guy who beat him in Iowa to be his running mate. 8 years later, Bush succeeded Reagan to the presidency. It all started in Iowa, but it wasn't quite that smooth sailing for Bush as Reagan completed his second term. Vice President Bush was the front runner who was expected to move up the ladder, but it was 1988, caucuses. He was embarrassed by the results. Not only did he lose to Senator Bob Doyle, but he also finished behind TV evangelicalist Pat Robertson, meaning that the caucuses had doubled surprise that year. In 92, Bill Clinton, who was then the governor of Arkansas, finished fourth in the Iowa caucuses and had to rally in the future primaries to secure Democratic nomination. That year, Iowa Senator Tom Harkin ran as a favorite son candidate who won easily. The next week, Harkin was sounded defeated New Hampshire and dropped out of the race. In recent years, he has reflected on the loss, saying, "Every 4 years, I send a thank you note to 12 people in New Hampshire who voted for me." For many of us, the memory of the still fresh 2004 Democratic caucuses governed Howard Dean in Vermont. Congressman Richard Gephardt of Missouri had been running 1-2 in the polls for several weeks. The big question seemed to be which one of them would come out of the winner. Surprise, Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts finished first. Senator John Edwards, North Carolina, finished second. And Dean and Gephardt finished back in the pack. Kerry wound up winning the nomination, and it started in Iowa. For Dean, it was the beginning of the end in Iowa. In 2008, two leading Republicans were Senator John McCain in Arizona, Mitt Romney of Massachusetts. McCain had pretty well written off Iowa because of his opposition to ethanol subsidies. The winner who came out of nowhere was Arkansas, Mike Huckabee. McCain eventually won the nomination. Where will the surprise come from this year? Here's the possibilities. All the polls show four candidates who are far ahead of the rest of the contenders: Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, and Pete Buttigieg. I think the surprise may come by someone else breaking that top four. Who will it be? Amy Klobuchar, Andrew Yang, or Tom Steyer? Think of the ramifications if it happens. The surprise contender will be thrust into the nomination limelight by exceeding expectations, always a headline grabber. But perhaps most significantly, the surprise contender will knock one of those top four into fifth place, which could be the kiss of death for the campaign. One thing is for sure, little old Lily White Iowa, one of the nation's smallest states and having the most bizarre way of selecting presidential preferences, will once again capture the attention of the nation. And trust me, there will be a surprise, John Skipper writes. Mike?
Okay. Some news here about the station itself. Amy Caduce joins KCMR-FM as new general manager. The KCMR Radio Board of Directors has named Amy Caduce as the new general manager. Caduce is a senior engineering project assistant at Collins Aerospace, formerly Rockwell Collins in Cedar Rapids. She previously worked as the director and senior producer at KIMT-TV in Mason City. She has also worked as a a producer at KMTV in Omaha and is executive producer and assistant news director at KGAN KFXA TV in Cedar Rapids. A native of Ventura, Caduceus graduated from the University of Iowa with a degree in journalism and cinema with a minor in music. I'm very excited to get back to my North Iowa roots and to be a part of the KCMR mission of being a positive influence in the community. I look forward to reacquainting myself to the area and its people, said Caduceus. We are delighted to have Amy on board, said KCMR Board President Jim Poppe. Her skills are ideally suited to lead KCMR into the future. Caduceus will start her duties at KCMR February 24. She will succeed Bill Schickel, who is retiring as the station's general manager after serving in the position for 23 years. He will work with Caduceus during her first week and will continue serving as mayor of Mason City. Susan?
Okay. I didn't catch anything. Let's see here. I was blowing my nose.
Okay, sorry. Adventure School program in Mason City seeks applicants looking to start your own business. Heading back to school may be your first step. North Iowa, or the University of Iowa's Venture School, Iowa's entrepreneurial training program developed by the University of Iowa John Papa John Entrepreneurial Center, will train entrepreneurs in Mason City region in a partnership with North Iowa Area Community College Papa John Center in spring of 2020. The 7-week venture program is built from a curriculum developed by the National Science Foundation, iCorps, at Stanford University and the University of California, Berkeley. Venture School is now accepting applications to participate in its spring program. Participants will gain marketing skills and make valuable connections to help them take their innovative idea to the next level. Orientation is on February 13, with the program running from 5:30 to 9 p.m. every Thursday, February 20 through April 9 at Nyack Papa John Center in Mason City. Application deadline is January 31. Visit www.ventureschool.com for more information. You find something?
Oh, I started shopping and then ads.
Okay, she's looking at ads. Noon Rotary Student of the Month, Luke Mulholland. Luke Mulholland is a senior at Mason City High School and was chosen as the Noon Rotary Club Student of the Month. Luke is the son of Tim Mulholland and Tanya Gray. He has a brother, Zach, and a sister, Audra. He participates in cross country and track. He is a 3-time letter winner in cross country and a 4-time winner in track. He has qualified for the straight track meet as a junior. He has been recognized on the principal's list honor roll and is a member of the National Honor Society. He volunteers at the First United Church, Methodist Church, and participates in the Silver Cord program. He works at Fairway and Parks and Rec. Luke's future plans are to attend University of Wisconsin-Madison with an undecided major. There's another Noon Rotary Student of the Month. Maya Lewerke, a senior at Mason City High School, is chosen as the Noon Rotary Student of the Month for January. She's the daughter of Rich and Natasha Lewerke and is the sister of Ladine Lewerke. Lewerke is a member of the Mason City High School Concert Choir and is vice president of the National Honor Society and Student Senate. She has lettered in academics and in National Honor Society. Her awards and honors include Honor Roll, 2-time CIML Art Show winner, and Silver Cord. She has also earned her CNA and will graduate from NIAC in May. Lewerke's community activities include many Student Senate and National Honor Society service projects. Lewerke plans to attend NIAC next year to pursue a degree in nursing. Susan, did you find something?
I did, on the sports page.
Awesome.
So there's some kids, and they have all sorts of baseballs around their feet and stuff like that. They're dressed up in their fancy outfits, and it says, so Adapt or die. Those words are spoken by Brad Pitt's character Billy Bean in the movie version of Moneyball and are more true than ever at levels of baseball. As college and professional baseball clubs look to future, being in the cutting edge is vital, maybe more than in any sport. No longer can your team depend solely on scouting to make judges and judgments on players. Instead, for teams, high schools, the pros are driving into baseball technology, advancing analytics just so they can keep it up. After several years ago, former NIACC baseball coach Travis Hergert decided that this program needed a change. And this talking about NIAC. And after 25-31 seasons in 2014, Hergert revamped the program, starting to focus more on advanced statistics, having made Major League Baseball teams like Houston Astros so successful, present scales aside, of course. Not only did that require a change in training methods, it changed in baseball philosophy and where very good results originated in terms of wins and losses, Hergert said at the GUCO Junior College level. We want to win, and we're very competitive, and we want to win more games. The shift in changing the team's measures of success. When that happened, two Trojans became one of the first junior college programs to publicly embrace advanced analytics and training methods. Hergert, who now works for the Philadelphia Phillies, began having his players train with weighted or underweighted bats and also hung strings around the batting cages to test exit velocity and how fast the ball was coming at the player's bat. On the pitching side, the Trojans began using weighted balls and velocity training to strengthen pitchers' arms. We had to get the guys throw harder and get the guys to be more efficient with their deliveries. That's when we adopted a lot of these training techniques. After adopting these new age techniques, the program began to see results right away. In 2015, the team went 49-16, made it to the third round of NJCAA Division II World Series. Offensively, we saw a huge jump on the pitching end. It took a little bit to evolve, and we ended up winning 20 of our last 21 that regional tournament 2015. The technology, most often a piece of equipment, team uses it called a Rapsodo. The system sits in the front of the home plate in the batting cage and measures the ball speed rate, and it comes off the bat as well as projected ball distance. Results are projected onto adjacent wall when a player takes their swing in the cage, and these numbers can be used to determine a player's training regime. It eliminates a lot of guesswork. I think it's a validation of what your strengths are and your weaknesses and how to enhance what you're focused on. And the Trojans can also measure the player's bat speed, spin rate, and the program also just got an electronic camera device that can capture 2,000 frames per second and show pitchers their delivery, super slow motion, and can be used to analyze the hitter's swing. Over the past five seasons, NIAC has been known entity in baseball world these days. It's a part of the pitch and the recruits if they want to eventually transfer to the Division I program. And let's see, I think that's about and it goes on to say, since the beginning of 2015 seasons, Trojans' overall record have been 204-97-1, with two trips to the NJCAA Division World Series and regional tournament appearances in every season. We never had a draft pickup until 2016, and so that is where the major shift through our process changed. Mike, do you have anything else?
All right. That brings us to the end, actually, of our reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Sunday, January 19, 2020. Your readers have been Susan Wiley, and I'm Mike Dam. This broadcast has come to you through a partnership between Iowa Radio Reading Information Service and 97.9 FM KCMR Radio. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of IRIS, the readers, or KCMR. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned for today's reading of the Des Moines Register. You are listening to IRIS, your 24-hour radio reading service. Have a great day.